welcome, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Karen. I'm really glad to be with you, and thank you for having me.
Oh, gosh, I've been looking forward to this for a very, very long time. Okay, so let's get started. There's a lot to talk about. You've probably talked about how you got on this path probably thousands and thousands of times. I know I've told your story hundreds of times, but just so the listeners know a little bit about you, can you just give a little brief introduction about what got you on the path?
Well, yes, I have told it so many times, but I was born into the Baskin-Robbins family. My dad and uncle were the founders and owners of the company. And my dad had planned for me to succeed him and take over the company and run it with him, and he groomed me for that purpose. But as my own values began to emerge, I felt pulled in a very different direction, and I walked away from that. I didn't work with him any longer, and I told him I didn't want to have any access or dependence on his financial achievements. So I led a very different life than the one he had outlined for me, and lived very simply, very frugally, trying to create a lifestyle that was in harmony with the earth, and be an advocate for that, for a way of life that respects the planet, respects ourselves as part of the Earth community, and respects the whole web of life, so that we don't prey on it, so that our economy isn't predatory, isn't exploitive, and so that it could become sustainable, which it hasn't done.
Well,
and now we're seeing the impact of that. The tremendous cost that the ecosystems are paying for our economic activities and for the way we have defined prosperity, the way we have sought success, the old good life, I call it, the shop till the planet drops. And I've written my new book, The New Good Life, because I think there is another vision of prosperity and success and human fulfillment and how we might live together on this earth.
Well, what I loved about, I think what I love most about this book were your personal stories. And I know people like to read about other people and their experiences, and there were some things that I didn't know about you, so it was really fun to read. And just how you did live so simply with your wife, Deo, for a period of time in this log cabin of sorts. And
well, it was a log cabin. It wasn't of sorts. It literally
was. Yeah,
well, I built it after I left Baskin-Robbins. We had to live very simply, and we wanted to live beautifully, though. We wanted a quality of life, even though we had very, very, very little money. So we ended up buying some land on a very remote part of a small island off the coast of British Columbia. We actually only paid $1,500 for the land. And then I built a one-room log cabin on it, and that's where we lived for the next 10 years. And we grew most of our own food during that time. Our son Ocean was born into my hands in that cabin. And it was a very, very simple life. It really was a pendulum swing from the way I had grown up, because mm-hmm. in the family in which I grew up, I used to jokingly say, but it was only half joking, that roughing it meant that room service was late.
Well, you know, it is all perspective.
You know, money can really isolate people. A lot of people with money use it to isolate themselves from others' suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do that, you disconnect from your ability to respond to other people's sufferings in a constructive way. If you're not feeling it, if you're not connected to it, you don't respond to it. And that's led to a tremendous gap between the rich and the poor, frankly, between the ultra-rich and just about everybody else now. And that annoys me, that offends me, that angers me, it grieves me, because it's not a way to live. It doesn't it's not in alignment with our compassion at all. And it's not sustainable socially, and it leads to economics of privilege rather than economics of nourishment.
Well, we've all been socialized to appreciate this old good life that you describe. And you bring up lots of good things in this book and lots of remedies to get to a better place, but it's really challenging because some of the things, for example, that you mention in the book, I live this book, and I try my best in my own personal life. We live in New York City. We don't own a car. We take the subway. I don't use a dryer for my laundry. We can't hang it out because we're not allowed to, but I dry clothes in the house. I'm always thinking, you know, what can I do to live more lightly on the planet? Okay, good for me. When I think of everyone else, they think I'm nuts. And people connect certain things to poverty. I know there are some people that connect to riding a bus, a public bus, with poverty.
Yeah, I remember being with a family once, and a bus drove by, and the kid, there was a 10-year-old boy, 10 or 11-year-old boy, and he said something like, there's all the poor people.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's going to be a big leap for a lot of people to get past that.
Yes, there is. And it's imperative because these stigmas, so that if you don't use a dryer but you hang out your laundry so the sun can dry it, which is free, and uses no fossil fuels, no coal, no oil, no energy, you get marginalized for that. Whereas that is the thing that's obviously more appropriate for our times. Is my voice echoing there?
I don't hear an echo, but if you want, we can call you back and get you a better connection.
I think we would, yeah.
Okay, so
I'll be right back.
You hang up, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
And while we're waiting for John to come back, I wanted to talk about a number of books that he's written. He's most well known for his book Diet for a New America, and it sold over a million copies. It's translated into many languages, and it really was groundbreaking for its time. It came out in 1987, and it talked about the connection between our food choices and the impact on, obviously, our health. We talk about that all the time, but the environment and the treatment of animals. And there's been a lot more discussion about it since that book came out, but it was really first of its kind. And so that's really what put John into the limelight, and that book made a tremendous impact on so many people. And we're still talking a lot about it today. Are you back?
I'm back.
Okay, I was just talking a little bit about Diet for New America while you were gone because that was such an important book.
Well, thank you. You know, eating low on the food chain has been associated with poverty, too. It's a peasant diet, and we've looked upon meat eating as the reward of affluence and the sign of affluence. To the detriment of our cardiovascular systems, to the detriment of the planet, to the detriment of the animals trapped in agribusinesses, factory farms, to the detriment of the people who aren't fed, don't have food available, who starve because grain that could have been available to them is fed to livestock.
And there are many, many more people that live outside of the Western world in developing countries that want to live more like us. And many of them are coming here, and they want our lifestyle, they want our cars, they want our diet.
I know, Hollywood sells it, and it, you know, the image is very attractive. We have developed a way of life that's high on image and low on substance, low on spirit, low on quality of connection to ourselves, to each other, low on community, high on competition. It's a really high-cost, low-joy lifestyle, but it's spreading worldwide, and it's up to us here in the belly of the beast, really, to start to transform the way we live and think and the way we relate to one another so that we can live with more respect for ourselves, more respect for each other, and more respect for the possibilities and opportunities of the changes that are now inevitable. You know, our economy is built on cheap oil to an extent that most people can't fathom. And so the inevitable increase in the price of oil, the inevitable decline in availability of oil, and other non-renewable polluting energies, is going to force us to restructure our economy. Are
well,
we going to do that
about,
consciously and intentionally, or are we going to be victims dragged through it?
In your book, you talk about the gross national product, the GDP, and I've read a lot about it, how it really is such an inadequate model of our resources and our wealth. And things that aren't taken into consideration is if people can grow their own food.
Well, the GDP or the GNP, which are basically cousins of each other, have been the measure by which we have assessed our economic growth and productivity and prosperity. If the GDP is rising, we say the economy is doing well. If it's stagnating, we get concerned. If it's dropping, we get frightened.
Mm-hmm.
But really, all the GDP does is measure the movement of money. And from a taxation viewpoint, where the movement of money is what is taxed, that makes some sense because you're measuring what you can tax. And if that's what you want to know, then that might be a valid indicator. But if you want to know anything about the quality of life that economy is supporting, the GDP and the GNP are terrible indicators. They're guaranteed to get everything wrong because they polluting activities count, but baking bread at home doesn't.
Right.
Paying for child care counts, but taking care of your own kids doesn't. BP's oil spill in the Gulf is tremendous for the GDP. It is fantastic for the GDP, but it is a catastrophe, obviously, for the ecosystems of the Gulf and really the whole planet.
Well, I like that you bring up in the book the one country in Bhutan that has the gross national happiness. I remember reading about that at some point and really delighted in that somebody's doing something to measure.
Well, they have actually instituted as their primary governmental criteria for assessing their policies the concept of gross national happiness.
It's a beautiful thing.
And they're very protective of the environment. Mining is illegal. Hunting is illegal. It's a Buddhist country. So respect for life, reverence for life is a highly esteemed value. Ranching is illegal. They are very, very careful about their forests. And since this policy has been instituted, this is a very poor country in monetary terms. And 50 years ago, the literacy rate in Bhutan was only about 10%. Now, it's 85%. Now, this country, which still has very few financial resources, does provide basic medical care for all of its citizens, something that the United States, with its exorbitant and extravagant levels of financial dealings, is not doing. So it kind of puts a little bit of shame, I think, on us when you see compare the priorities.
Well, I really believe it's up to the individual to make a difference. And one of the great things about you and all the books that you've written is you certainly walk the walk, and you don't just talk the talk. You practice everything that you preach. And we all need to be, as Gandhi would say, the change that we want to see. And that's really hard for a lot of people. People say, well, how is what I'm doing going to make a difference? I'm only one person. And I really think it starts there. We have to know that each one of us doing
well,
what we believe in makes a
difference. That's one thing we have control over, is our own choices and actions and attitudes. When you add kindness to the world, you're making a contribution that's very different than if you add disdain. If you treat others contemptuously, if you talk down to them, if you think poorly of them, if you judge them, if you push people away with that kind of attitude, you create a vibration that then feeds out through the network of humanity in different ways. On the other hand, if you bring out the best in other people, if you treat them with respect, If you bring kindness and beauty and compassion into your lives and into the way you are with others as best you can and as often as you can, and you work and struggle to do that, then what happens is life becomes lighter for you, and the people around you have more gratitude and feel better, and self-esteem grows, and everything that's good starts to bloom. And this is how we do it. It's through how our lives interact with one another.
It can be contagious.
It is.
Yeah, I know just by walking on the streets in New York City, where people do not tend to smile when they don't know you.
No.
When you smile at them, you usually get a smile back. Now, some people might think you're crazy smiling, because we do have some of those walking around the street, too. But I think it is a contagious thing where just a smile can make someone else feel better.
Well, if you live your life inhibited by the fear that other people will think you're crazy, that's pretty constrictive. And, I don't care that much what people think of me. And that's one of the steps that has given me freedom to actualize my potential and to express my creativity and to enjoy my passions and to make a difference, you know, in the world at whatever level I can.
Yeah, well, that's one of the secrets, not to care what other people think. In a good way. I mean, certainly your friends and family, you want to know how they are and what they're thinking. But you have to follow your calling.
The fear of other people's disapproval,
mm-hmm.
can for a lot of us, it ends up running our lives to the extent that we don't find our unique joy and strength.
So in your book, in the early part of the book, you talk about this experience you had with an old TV show called Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And it was really a fun story to read. I hadn't heard about it before, where you talk about they approached you to do a show. And if anyone remembers that show, it was specifically about how the very rich live, and you get to see this overwhelming abundance and luxury and consumption, and I guess you're supposed to dream that this is the ideal life and just catching a glimpse of it is a good thing. But you weren't living that way.
No, we were kind of the opposite of it, and yet they called me and wanted to do a show on me and feature me, and I couldn't believe it, honestly, because I was the opposite of everything that they're about. And I told her so, the producer who called. I said, you know, your lifestyles of the rich and famous, you glorify the shallowest parts of people. Your motto should be shop till the planet drops. You know, at a time when the environment is groaning under the impact of our out-of-control consumption, your show doesn't have a place as far as I'm concerned. And every spiritual tradition and every religion has taught that to seek your ultimate satisfaction and fulfillment and peace through the acquiring of material things and consumption is insane and won't get you there. And yet, here you are preaching that very error. So I told her I didn't want to have anything to do with the show. But she was very persistent. And she said, well, look, once a year we're allowed to do a different kind of show. Once a year we're allowed, we the people on the staff here, are allowed to put together a show.
That means something.
that is about people who are doing really good things with their wealth, you know, philanthropists and so forth. And I said, well, that's very nice. I wish you did that show every week, and once a year you did your stupid show. But still, at the time, I had very little money, and I wasn't a philanthropist. I would have loved to have been a philanthropist, but I didn't have any extra money at all beyond our basic needs. So, and even that was sometimes a challenge. So I said, you know, I don't live that way. And she said, well, some of us on the staff have read your books, and we think they're incredibly important. We want to get your message out to an audience that's very large and that probably otherwise might not be exposed to it. And we want to be creative and find a way to do this with you. And that kind of won me over. So I said, well, I guess. And they did it. They ended up doing something very tasteful and beautiful. They have me on this show. This is Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous,
mm-hmm.
of all shows. And I'm quoting Thoreau saying, I make myself rich by making my wants few. Now, that's really not their typical message,
mm-hmm.
but they have me on there quoting that. They show our little home, and it was actually fun. And at the end of the show, the end of the segment on me anyway, it was the end of the show as well, they brought up a photograph of the Earth from space. It was first taken in 1969. When we first saw the planet suspended amongst the stars, this
mm-hmm.
beautiful jewel,
mm-hmm.
an exquisite thing, the first image of the whole Earth that we had.
Right.
And they brought up that photograph, and the lovely music behind it, and they kept that image on the screen for some time, which is unusual. They usually flick the images constantly
mm-hmm.
to keep you uncentered and susceptible to advertising's predations. But they left it up there, and they said, this man's life goes to show that he who believes, he who dies with the most toys wins, doesn't see the whole picture.
Mm.
And there was the photograph of the whole Earth.
It's almost like the Earth was sending us that message. Or...
Yeah, I felt that, and I thought if this message of my, that I'm trying to advocate for and understand and that my life represents to people can be found on a show like that of all places, then something is going on here that beyond what meets the eye.
Okay, let's continue talking about the media, because that's one of the reasons why we're in this damaged place that we're in today. People in general tend to be like sheep. We want what we see others having. We want what we see on television, telling us what we want, telling us what to think. Just as a tiny little silly example, last night on the news, there was this brief little program, a researcher, a study, talking about plastic bags and canvas bags and kind of giving a warning about canvas bags that you have to be really careful because you have to wash them. Because if they get dirty, you might spread some bacteria and, you know, do horrible things. And if, and they did tell that the research was done by the companies that make plastic bags. But crazy kinds of information come from the media that make people very confused and misguided.
Well, they're always trying to show the opposition side and keep the... You know, it's like with global warming. The scientific consensus... that the Earth is warming due to the due in part to human activities and the burning of fossil fuels and the building up of carbon in the atmosphere is overwhelming. It's the degree of unanimity amongst climatologists is extraordinary, and they're saying not only that it's happening, but that it's happening rapidly. That is extremely dangerous to the future of life on Earth, or to the future of human life on Earth in any event. To the nature of civilization, and yet the media treats it as though that, well, that's half the story, and then the skeptics have the other half, and so they give them equal time as if they were equally valid.
Mm-hmm.
That keeps people confused. That plays very deeply into the pockets of the oil industry, the coal industry, the status quo, basically. I think every one of us has an opportunity to be complicit, an accomplice to the status quo. Or everyday revolutionaries, warriors for a different way of life.
I like that.
And that is the choice that we make. We make it every day.
It really surprises me sometimes, even in relatively intelligent sources, like in the New York Times this last weekend, there was an in-depth article about the tuna industry and how bluefin tuna is now on its way out because of this aggressive hunting and fishing that's going on. And it was really in depth and talking about, even in fish farming, how lots of smaller fish and algae need to be scooped out of the ocean to feed these farmed fish and how inefficient it is. And yet, at the end of this small type, many-page, in-depth article, never did he say, we should eat lower on the food chain and we should all be eating more plant foods.
I know. It's that more is better mentality that we've had that makes it very difficult to us to face that it's our choices, our lifestyles, our actions, our consumption that is driving, in this case, the strip mining of the oceans. the extinction of fish stocks. And the pollution of the oceans as well, which is contributing, as is our voracious consumption, to the decimation of the fish stocks and of the whole ecosystems of the oceans. Between our overfishing and our pollution, one example of which is this egregious geyser of oil and methane erupting into the Gulf of Mexico right now.
Mm-hmm. And one of the messages we get is to eat more fish.
Yeah.
Keep these farmers, these fishermen in business.
Well, they won't be in business for long,
no.
Particularly in the Gulf. That accident is it's a catastrophe of almost biblical proportions, really. And it's showing, it's illustrating how unsustainable our entire way of life is. When you say somebody is a success, if you say somebody is successful, isn't it that what you're actually saying is that they have made a lot of money or have a lot of money?
Absolutely.
So we define success in monetary terms. And when we do that, and we do that so commonly that we don't even think about it, but when we do that, I think we actually impoverish ourselves. Because it leads to people equating their self-worth with their net worth. It leads to people thinking that only by having more money and spending more money and having more stuff and projecting the image that you can, when you do that, of a successful person, that you can be well thought of.
We need to talk a lot more about that. We need to talk a lot more about that because it's a very important point, but we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes. And if you have any comments or questions, you can send me an email right now at info@realmeals.org, and we'll be right back in a couple of minutes. Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And I have with me John Robbins, who's the author of the very wonderful new book, The New Good Life, Living Better Than Ever in the Age of Less. John, we were just talking about success. And this is such an important topic because so many people really feel that money is what defines success.
Yes, but that's not going to be possible in the coming economy. The days, it's really hard for many people to comprehend the degree to which our economy has been based on cheap oil.
Mm-hmm.
And there is debate now about whether we have reached or when we will reach what's called peak oil. But that date may only be known with any certainty in retrospect. What we do know for certain now is that we have reached the day of tough oil. Any new oil discoveries, any new ability to extract oil from the earth is costly. It is difficult. It is in difficult places to reach. It is in unstable political situations. It is non-conventional oil, such as from oil sands and shale. These all things are very expensive and polluting to get at. The low-hanging fruit in terms of oil has been harvested.
Hmm.
And now it's much harder and more costly to get oil. The good news on that is that as the price of oil goes up, and it will predictably and painfully.
I shouldn't be buying a new car then.
No, and if you buy a Prius or a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid or an electric car or an electric bike, that's what I'm looking into personally. But the point is that we have to find a way to uncouple our economy from oil. And that's going to mean local food and local energy sources, and it's going to mean everything local. It may mean that, on the good side, the recovery to a degree of our manufacturing base, which we've basically given up on. We've been buying all our stuff from China because the cost of labor there is so much lower. And there isn't the corporations aren't hampered by environmental regulations or human rights concerns. But the cost of transporting the goods and is going to increase as the price of oil goes up. And with that, the cost advantage of that cheap labor is going to go away. So maybe we can start to create jobs again in this country that are green.
Well, you know, just like you had pointed out in your first book, Diet for a New America, about how our food choices impact not only our health, but the environment and the treatment of animals, one thing that I was always reminded of was that eating a plant-based diet was good for all reasons, and there were no negative downsides to that. It benefited so many different things. And so taking it up a notch, I would like to believe that the things that we're going to do, that we have to do, bringing industry local and making most, if not all, of the things that we need in our own local communities is going to be good for everything, for all reasons, for the planet, for the environment, for our own well-being, for our economy.
If we take the reins, that's what will happen. If we do business as usual and just continue trying to find our economic prosperity through more and more growth and globalization and don't recognize the limitations of our oil addiction, really,
mm-hmm.
It's going to be rough. It's going to be brutal.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so I'm a believer, as I mentioned before, that it's really up to us as the individuals to make a difference in our lives and move forward. But I've been reading a bit about some of the very rich, like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, who have been trying to get the other billionaires to contribute half of their wealth to good causes. How do you feel about those folks kind of, doing good, but also is it up to them to kind of decide what's right for all of us?
Well, the way we've structured our economy, those individuals have an absolutely extravagant share of the wealth, and it is in their hands at the moment what they do with that wealth, and if they choose to follow the lead of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates in this case. And Ted Turner started this some years ago also.
Mm-hmm.
And take the socially responsible path rather than the self-indulgent path. It would be a tremendous thing.
Yeah,
and it would set an example.
For all business.
But I think we need to develop an economic system that where the money is more socially just. It's not right that a CEO makes more money before his coffee break in one morning than the average worker in the company makes in a year.
Or in their lifetime sometimes.
Or in their lifetime sometimes. It's just not right. And it takes a toll on all of us, you know, to have that degree of wealth separation, that big a gap. And the concentration of economic resources in the hands of the very few has costs to all of us, including those very few, by the way, that we don't see when we're hypnotized into this consumer trance. The new good life is breaking free from that trance, and it's raising your quality of life, even though your standard of living, which is, again, measured in monetary terms,
mm-hmm.
May be going down.
Mm-hmm.
We need to learn how to live elegant, beautiful, creative, passionate, loving, quality lives with less stuff, dependent on less energy from outside, more locally based, more relationship based, so we find the joy and our capacity for joy in our relationships with one another, in our relationships to the living earth and to the spirit of our times and to the best in humanity.
We all certainly need a shift in perspective about what really means something and what doesn't. And you're right, you made a good point in your book about what your real hourly wage is. And it was enlightening or eye-opening to read about how what our time is worth, especially in terms of the jobs that we have and the salaries that we make, and then in turn as you put it, the products that we buy, how many hours of work does it take to get that?
It does put a different light on your spending habits when you see how much time it has taken you, or it does take you, to acquire the resources to purchase that product or service. And I'm a big fan of frugality. I don't like waste. I don't like to see food wasted. I don't like to see money wasted. I don't like to see human spirits wasted. I think if we have more time and less stuff, we can be more creative. We can be more joyful. There'll be more laughter in our lives, more love in our lives, more truth in our lives. We can revolt then against the oppressions that we've internalized. We can see the patterns that no longer serve us, and we can reflect also on our public policies and become citizens again instead of just consumers. There's been some way that we've been defined as consumers rather than citizens.
Mm-hmm.
That has, you know, if you can get large numbers of people to willingly acquiesce in their own brainwashing, you don't need blatantly totalitarian government.
Well, just as an example, when Obama was running for president, there was a tremendous surge in interest and energy and people getting all excited about making a difference. But unfortunately, once he took office, I think people felt like, okay, it's up to this guy to make everything better for us, and we can go back to doing everything that we've been doing. And people just don't take enough responsibility for their own lives.
Yeah, well, I thought Obama was a really exciting candidate. I do not find him to be a particularly exciting president.
Yeah.
And how that got lost is still a bit of an enigma to me. What's very, very clear is that each of us is going to have to take a great deal of responsibility for the quality of our lives in the days to come. And if we, you know, a lot of the old assumptions that were the tenets, the basic tenets of the American faith, are no longer valid or credible. For example, it used to be understood that if you worked hard and showed up and were honest and cooperated, you could count on a decent life, raising your kids, putting them through college, medical care when you needed it, a decent retirement. If you did your part and played by the rules, you could count on that. But now it really isn't true anymore.
No.
And it's not going to be true. People are going to have to be much more creative, inventive, and responsible in their economic lives. And are going to need to learn how to live better in an age of less. And that's why I wrote The New Good Life, really, is to give people solid ground on which they can build their economic lives in these times to come, in the coming economy.
Well, there's a lot of wonderful things in this book, and I really encourage everybody to pick up a copy. There's just lots of very practical, good information in addition to uplifting, inspiring information. And one of the things that I liked is what you wrote about your wife, Deo, when your daughter in love.
Yes. Well, I live, I'm very fortunate to live, actually, in a three-generational situation. My wife and I have been married 44 years, and we live with our 36-year-old son. And his wife, who is our daughter in love,
love that.
Has lived with us for 16 years,
mm-hmm.
and their sons, our grand twins, who are 9 and a half, the boys were born extremely premature, and there was substantial and repeated oxygen deprivation to their brains at birth and afterwards, which is not a good thing, and it. They have a lot of special needs. So raising them is actually quite exhausting sometimes. It's very demanding. And it's a very good thing that there are four adults here, four parents, really, in that my wife and I are very involved. And Dale, my wife, in particular, spends a great number of hours with the boys. And one day, Michelle, our daughter in love, was thanking Dale, my wife, for the great number of hours she puts in. And she said to her, do you have any idea how much money you're saving us in child care? And Dale shot me a look that just said volumes to me about how much he enjoys often playing with the boys, and also how she didn't want Michelle to feel indebted. And then what she said was, she said something so amazing. She said, well, that's one way of looking at it. But on the other hand, do you have any idea how much money you're saving us? Do you know how much it would cost us if we had to go out and rent grandchildren? See, that's the new good life. You know, if generations are together and if the values are compatible and the, which is a necessity for generations to be together, it can be a wonderful thing. And it's really traditional. I mean, that's the way people have lived throughout the centuries. I think that there's an awful lot of kids today who don't even know their grandparents.
That's right.
And that's a loss. Mm-hmm. That's a tragedy, really, in our human in the community of America.
Yes, I agree.
It's a loss for the children, and it's a loss for the grandparents.
Everyone,
too.
Of
and
course.
It's a loss for the parents because they need the help.
That's right.
And you know,
it's tough though because not everyone can live together like your family does.
Oh, I understand that, and I wouldn't want to live with my parents, so I totally get it. But I said, if your values are compatible and congruent in a way, then it works. But you can always have extended families. You know, Hillary Clinton wrote a book with a title based on an African proverb that it takes a whole village to raise a child. If you're raising special needs twins the way we are, it takes two villages or three. And I'm really grateful for all the friends and our extended family, our community, that helps out and pitches in and supports in different ways. Because when times are difficult, we need each other.
Well, and people may not know this, but you recently experienced something very difficult in terms of your financial situation with Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, we lost 95% of our net worth overnight.
Mm-hmm.
I was not an investor with Bernie Madoff. I had never heard of Bernie Madoff, but I had invested our money with a financial advisor who was a dear friend. He had invested it in a company that then got invested three steps down the line with Madoff. So I didn't know it, and I was told things about our investment that turned out to be untrue, quite a number of them, actually. So, you know, what happened to us is overnight was very, very hard to deal with. But it's there's a lot of people who are losing the rug from under their feet today economically, and a lot of people, maybe not overnight, maybe over the course of a year or two, but a lot of people are finding that the things they relied on for their economic security aren't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The things that they were counting on for their retirement, things they were counting on to sustain their lives aren't there. And this kind of suffering can be very, very challenging to people's lives. And it's really the reason I wrote The New Good Life, is to help people live better than ever, even with this kind of adversity, even with the limitations that this involves. There are ways to do it, where you find your resilience, where you find your resourcefulness, where you find your ability to respond to these challenges, to this adversity, in ways that really serve your spirit and serve your relationships. Someone once said that joys that are shared amongst friends are doubled. Sorrows that are shared amongst friends are halved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the spirit, anyway, in which I'm talking. That when we work together and build relationships of respect and mutual reciprocity and commitment, courageous commitment to our own and each other's well-being, then we can go through these difficult times with intelligence, with wisdom, with instead of with fear and agitation.
You co-authored a book about 20 years ago, 1991, with Anne Mortief, In Search of Balance.
Yes, it was later released as The Awakened Heart, actually.
Right. And do you ever go back to that book and read some of the profound things that are in here? It's almost like many little prayers and meditations.
Yes, that's really what it is. And pretty much on a daily basis, I not necessarily read that book, but I write things like we wrote in that book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I'm trying to center myself in my spiritual potential. I'm trying to find my solid ground in what really matters and let my mind be guided by the wisdom of my heart and of our collective heart, because that's where our courage is, in that connection with one another. I don't mean heart in the sentimental sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean heart in the sense of courage, strength, that which grounds us in our commitment to accomplish, to effectively persevere, to follow through, to manifest competence and strength in the way that we live together.
Did you pick the title for the book, The New Good Life?
Actually, it was my agent who thought of that title. I love it, though.
Yeah, I love it, too. Was it in any connection with Scott and Helen Nearing's book?
Well, yes, and it was. You know, Helen Nearing was a very dear friend of mine and of our families, and I didn't know Scott except through his work. I met Helen shortly after Scott died, but they, of course, wrote the Good Life, and they had the Good Life Center in Maine, and at one time Helen wanted to bequeath that to Dale and I.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw us as the stewards. She saw us actually in many ways as the successors to them in
mm-hmm.
the way that they were living and what they were about. She was a lifelong vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very spiritual woman. Her first boyfriend had been Jiddu Krishnamurti, the famous philosopher. She left him for Scott. Pretty fine people. She had lots of fine people in her life. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman. And she and Scott were true mentors and exemplars for many generations.
Well, what I find interesting about it is that my understanding is that they left the world that they were in to this new life, this good life where it was at the time of the Depression, and they were both professionals and then decided to buy some land up in Vermont and just farm. And the story is fascinating, but they had balance in their life, how they would work hard for
yeah.
part of the day, but then it made sure they had time for reading and relaxing and being with friends.
You've got to have time for loafing.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of loafing has got to be understood. Now, by loafing, I do not mean watching television and mind-numbing activities. But what I do mean is time that you can be creative, time for hobbies, times to hang out with people, times to watch the sunrise or the sunset, times to dance and sing, times to celebrate the transitions of your lives and the lives of people that are in your circles, times to be with those who are hurting and help to be a strength as those times. We need time for that. And if all of our time is spent in making money and spending it, as is the case for a great number of Americans, then we don't have the time left for our souls, to nurture our souls, to take care of our souls, and to take care of the earth, and to take care of our animals, and to take care of our friends, and to take care of our family, and our deepest human needs, then don't get met while we are busy satisfying wants that really aren't essential, that have been imposed on us by advertising and the corporate agenda. The ability to make a discernment between our real true needs and our external wants that are extraneous, that are alienating, that are superficial, to make that distinction and then to organize our lives, structure our lives in terms of our true needs. To me, that is one of the principles, the underlying principles of the New Good Life.
You've written many wonderful books, and they're all worth reading. Dies for New America, May All Be Fed, Reclaiming Our Health, The Food Revolution, the book you co-authored, The Awakened Heart, Healthy at 100, and now this new book. You've also been posting articles on Huffington Post recently that have been really very informative. And
you
have a website, johnrobbins.info, where there's all kinds of wonderful things up there as well. One thing I noticed, you ended all of your books except this one with "May all be fed, may all be healed, may all be loved." And I know that that's a signpost on the path to your home, and it's really a beautiful combination of statements. But this book, you ended a little differently. "May your time on this earth fill your heart to overflowing. May love be your blanket peace, your pillow, and joy your constant companion." Is there a reason why you chose some new words?
Oh, I don't know, Karen. They say the same thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I guess sometimes I change the words just to keep my mind awake. You know, the prayer, "May all be fed, may all be healed, may all be loved," it's inscribed in my cells.
Mm-hmm.
It occupies my thoughts to an extent that I can't even describe. It's in my breath. It's in my dreams. It's in my it's really in every moment of my being. And but it's also a prayer on behalf of all of us, and that's one of the key things. I've never thought that personal satisfaction, personal fulfillment, is in and of itself sufficient. I mean, it's nice, and I want all of us to have that, but at a certain point, the commitment of my life certainly is inclusive. And as long as there's anyone who is starving to death or suffering from preventable illnesses that we aren't preventing because of our lifestyles, because of our pursuit of the old good life, then I'm not satisfied and I'm not at peace.
Mm-hmm.
I need us all to recognize the human family and our role in it. And that if my success is dependent on your poverty, if my consumption levels and satisfaction of those desires is dependent on the violation of cultures or of animals or of ecosystems or of segments of our society, it's not success. It's not valid. It's not credible to me. And I'm always listening for ways that we can awaken together into our responsibility to one another.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Is there, I know so many people are just overwhelmed in their lives with their responsibilities, and when they hear things like this about how to make a difference, you know, it deep in their heart they want to, but they're just so overwhelmed. Is there a good place to start?
Start anywhere you can. Start where you are. Start to find ways to live with more respect for yourself. Start to find ways to live with more respect for other people. And from that, every step leads you in closer to the heart of life, closer to the powers that you carry inside yourself. Calm your mind. Simplify your life. Get out of debt. And be free to be the beautiful, magnificent, loving, caring human being that you are.
Well, I wish that for all of us.
Yeah, me too.
Hmm.
Thank you, Karen. You're an inspiration to me, always have been, and I'm sure you are to all of our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for this book and everything that you've written and everything in the future that you're going to give to the world.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. You've been listening to It's All About Food. My guest was John Robbins. You can go to his website, johnrobbins.info, and please pick up a copy of his wonderful new book, The New Good Life, Living Better Than Ever in an Age of Less. You can join me next week. My guest will be Jim May, founder and president of Sweet Leaf Stevia Sweetener, and we'll talk about the wonderful benefits of stevia. Thanks for listening.